As I had mentioned on Sunday morning, decided to do what I realized was a long overdue study, and that is an overview study of the events of the final week of the life in this world and ministry of the Lord Jesus. And we got started, we got some good progress accomplished, and what we covered, of course, was Sunday's events and Monday's events. Sunday being Palm Sunday, with all the significance of the greeting the Lord Jesus with palm fronds and the riding into the city on the donkey's colt, and all of the Old Testament and biblical significance of those connections. What we call the triumphal entry of the Lord. Really the public acknowledgement and recognition of him as Messiah, the long-awaited Messiah of Israel. And then on Monday, as he went each night, as we've already talked about, out of the city of Jerusalem, back across the Kidron Valley and up the Mount of Olives to a small village called Bethany, where he stayed each night of this week. So each morning, he got up and returned back to the city of Jerusalem, with the exception, as we'll talk about in a moment, of Wednesday. But so Monday morning, he comes back into the city. On the way, he sees the fig tree. He expects to find figs on it, does not find figs, curses the fig tree. All of that, as we saw Sunday morning, signifying a spiritual symbol that was drawn from Old Testament imagery to describe the Lord's frustrations, in a sense, spiritual frustrations, with the lack of expected fruit from his covenant nation of Israel, and then the impending judgment that was to fall upon the unfruitful tree of Israel because of that their failure on their part to give heed to the Lord's words, to obey them, and to be fruitful in his service. And then we ended our study there at the end of Monday night's events as he returned to Bethany, only to get up Tuesday morning for the next day's events. So I had mentioned I would cover the rest of the week, and as I've continued my study, it's kind of an evolving study here for myself, having never prepared this particular study before. So what I'm going to do is this. I'm going to call this one the final week, part two, and Sunday will be part three. So for tonight, what I'm going to cover is the events of Tuesday, Wednesday, and Thursday, bringing us up to the anniversary of Thursday night. And we'll go all the way until Thursday night midnight, because those events right up to the very end of Thursday are deeply important and significant. And then we will save Friday morning. I'm talking about early Friday morning, right after midnight. And of course, all of Friday's events, including the cross, the events of Saturday after he has died and has been buried. And then of course, the most important events of the entire week, really signifying a new week beginning on the following Sunday morning, which is, of course, Resurrection Sunday, what we now traditionally refer to as Easter Sunday. So on Sunday, we will cover Friday, Saturday, and Sunday, and tonight, Tuesday, Wednesday, and Thursday. So join me, if you would, in the Gospel of Matthew, chapter 21, and we're picking up with Tuesday's events. Tuesday morning in the final week. Matthew 21, and really, as you might imagine, because all of the four Gospels cover these events, and each Gospel writer was given his own assignment from the Lord to highlight and focus on specific details, it would be ideal if we were doing this study in the greatest detail. If, for instance, instead of like a three-part study, I was doing, as I normally do with such things, a 30-part study, we would slow down and we would look at every detail in each one of the Gospels connected to each one of these events. But because I'm doing a brief overview to just give us all a clear sense of the progression of these events and their connectedness to God's purpose, we're just going to primarily focus on the events as recorded in the Gospel of Matthew, and I will just take us occasionally to Mark, Luke, and John to highlight some very important details that can't be left out. So the first is in Matthew 21, and we are going to read from verses 23 through 27. This is Tuesday morning now as he has returned to the city. Now, you'll just have to trust me when I say this is Tuesday morning, because when we come to this portion in the scripture, it does not say at the beginning of the paragraph, this is now Tuesday morning. So it's only by virtue of those who have spent enough time and focused enough on the details of the events as they're unfolding in all four Gospels in comparison that we can clearly identify which event is connected to which day. And I'm asking you to kind of take my word for the sequence of events in terms of specific days. But if you're interested in those details, I can provide you more details outside of the study itself. So Matthew 21, verse 23. When he entered the temple, so he's left Bethany Tuesday morning. He's taken it's a between 2 and 3 mile walk down from the Mount of Olives through the Kidron Valley, back up the ascent to the Temple Mount, overlooking that eastern section of the city of Jerusalem. And now he's entered the precincts of the temple. And as he enters the temple that day, he's got an official delegation that's waiting for him. Remember what's happened this is Tuesday morning, just 2 days prior to this. The entire city was in an uproar as the entire city turned out as he was riding a donkey's colt through that Kidron Valley and up to the Temple Mount, and they're bringing palm fronds out and they're laying their garments on the road for him to ride over, and they're proclaiming publicly out loud, Hosanna to the Son of David. They're acknowledging him as Messiah. So now here, 2 days later, word has certainly traveled through the city and specifically to all of the official religious leaders of the city. As he enters the temple precinct, he has got a delegation meeting him. And remember, there was one other important thing between his triumphal entry and this event. What has he done between Sunday and Tuesday? He went in and cleared out the temple. He disrupted all the temple business. He disrupted all the temple traffic. And now he's got an official designation of temple officials that want to talk to him. And they're not coming to talk to him to say, oh, Messiah, we're so glad you're here. They're coming to talk to him to confront him and to challenge him. When he entered the temple, the chief priests and the elders of the people came up to him as he was teaching and said, by what authority are you doing these things, and who gave you this authority? So Jesus entered the temple and he began to teach as his normal pattern was. The temple, he wasn't in the actual, just so you know clearly, this is like a top-down view. This being the temple itself, which is kind of a rectangular structure with two main rooms in it. But surrounding the temple was a large courtyard. And outside of that was another courtyard, and outside of that was another courtyard, one being the courtyard for the Gentiles to have access to, and the other courtyard for the women. And in this circumstance, he's in one of these three courtyard areas, and he's teaching the people. And the chief priests and the elders, the chief priests being the ones in charge of the temple and all of its precincts, now they're coming to him to confront him, and they ask him this question. Not a good-hearted, open-hearted question, not sincerely curious and wondering, what's the authority that you have to do these things? They're challenging him because they do not believe he has the authority to do these things, and they certainly don't want the people thinking he has the authority to do these things. So they say to him, by what authority are you doing these things, and who gave you this authority? And Jesus doing something in response that is somewhat unexpected. Instead of answering their question directly, because what would be the clear and direct answer to that question? God gave me the authority. Would that be the truth? Absolutely, it would be the truth. What's the problem? They wouldn't accept it and they wouldn't believe it because their hearts are already hardened before the question is even asked. So there's something we can learn from that, which is, you know, these people are not in a good, open-hearted condition. They're not coming to the Lord for answers and for salvation. They're not coming to the Lord in order for him to teach them. They're coming in order to put him in his place. And so he doesn't give them the truth. Instead, what he does is he turns the tables on them, and he does something that is very useful in debate and argumentation, and that's actually the circumstance in which he finds himself in. he's challenged by them, and so he immediately turns it around and challenges them. He challenges them to give an answer, and he says, I also will ask you one question, and if you tell me the answer, then I also will tell you by what authority I do these things. The baptism of John, here's his question back to them, which is, it's interesting because it's a very strategic challenge that he makes to them. He doesn't challenge them about himself. He challenges them to give their perspective of an earlier important spiritual figure, John the Baptist, one who was broadly acknowledged by the people as a true prophet from God. So he says, the baptism of John, from where did it come? From heaven or from man? In other words, was John's ministry from God? Was he called by God? Was he ministering by God's authority? Or was it just John just doing his own thing, and kind of a natural ministry with no spiritual authority behind it? And they discussed it among themselves. Meaning, he's asked them the question. It's a public scenario. They're right out here in public, and people all around are listening to what's going on. Instead of answering his question, they turn to each other and they have a little, you know, they have a little huddle and they say, let's figure out how to answer this, because this is a tough question that he's asking us. They recognize there's a problem with either answer that they could give. So they say, if we say it's from heaven, he's then going to respond, why then did you not believe him? Because they didn't submit to the baptism of John. They should have, but they refused to go out and be baptized by him. But if we say from man, meaning disavow John's calling, disavow John as a prophet entirely, then what's going to happen is we are afraid of the crowd, for they all hold that John was a prophet. So they answered Jesus, we don't know. And he said to them, neither will I tell you by what authority I do these things. Now that sets off the events of the day. So the first big thing that we're meant to understand about the events of Tuesday is it's a sequence in the temple, or a series of confrontations. And challenges. And it's essentially describing Jesus versus the religious leaders of Jerusalem in various capacities. Now, they're not physically fighting each other, but they are spiritually locked in battle in this sequence of confrontations and challenges. So, it starts with this initial challenge by the chief priests. So challenge number one is chief priests. They're the highest level in the city of Jerusalem, spiritually speaking, religiously speaking at that time. And the elders, and in one of the Gospels, it also includes the group of scribes. Meaning, the chief priests were the actual temple priests, the Levitical priests, the elders, included the what we would call the high council members, the Sanhedrin, and the scribes were from the Pharisee camp. So there were representatives of all of the major religious leaders that greeted him there, not friendly greeting, but in a challenging kind of confrontational greeting. Now, what Jesus does next is very important. It's very interesting. When they challenge him and he responds with a challenge back to them and they refuse to answer his challenge because they know he's got them right where he wants them. And if they answer, their lack of spiritual integrity will be exposed to the entire precinct of the temple and everyone will see them in their true colors. At that point, they pull back. They pull back kind of like what happened when Jesus was tempted in the wilderness by Satan through the three tests in the wilderness. And Satan, after Jesus passed all three of the tests with flying colors, in one of the Gospels it says, Satan withdrew from him until when? Until there was a more opportune time. Meaning strategically, he knows there's no way I can win this circumstance, so I'm going to pull back, I'm going to bide my time, and I'm going to wait for another opportunity. So these religious leaders pull back here Tuesday morning. They're going to wait for another opportunity, but Jesus doesn't wait, and he begins to address the real heart issue as represented by these chief priests, these elders, and these scribes. And he does so by challenging them publicly without a face-to-face confrontation. Now he's going to teach everybody that's willing to listen about them and about what's really going on with them. But he does so in a way that we're familiar with through the format of parables. Now, we're all familiar with parables. We know that they're invented stories. They're not stories of real life events, but they use images from real life in order to drive home important spiritual points and principles that Jesus wants to get across to those whom he's teaching. But when Jesus, earlier in his ministry, we're talking about 3 years earlier in his ministry, when Jesus first began to use this teaching form called parables, he also explained to his disciples why he used parables. Because at one point, the disciples came to him and said, "These are good stories, but we don't fully understand the point. We're missing some of what you're after here." And so he would set them down and he would more fully explain the parable to them. But when they asked him why he taught in that manner, do you remember what his response was? He's basically saying the parable form of instruction is an expression of judgment upon those that receive the parable because their hearts are not in the right place to receive direct instruction. And so the parable is God's way to reach a hardened heart if it is reachable. And if it's not reachable, it's God's way to expose the truth to those who will listen, but to keep the truth from those who refuse to listen all at the same time. It's kind of like, remember when King David had sinned with Bathsheba and he was not close to the Lord for that period of his life. And the Lord had to send a prophet to confront him in his sin. And the prophet came to him and told David, not directly face to face, "David, you've sinned," because his heart was so hardened at that point that the prophet himself would have been at risk from the king's wrath. Instead, what the prophet did was told David a parable, told him a story. And he was able, by the grace of God, to see himself in that story as God opened his eyes, and the prophet at the end of the parable said to him, "This is your story, this is you, you're the man." And finally, the Lord penetrates David's heart with conviction, his heart is broken, and he repents. So now Jesus, because these religious leaders whose hearts should have been softest toward the Lord in all the population of Israel, all of God's covenant people, the leaders should have had the most open hearts, the most soft hearts toward the Lord, but their hearts were closed and hardened. And so now Jesus, for the sake of the rest of the people in Israel who are under their influence, speaks about them in parables, and he does so in a sequence of three stories. It's a teaching unto itself, these three parables, but I'm just going to overview them and identify them as three judgment parables. The three parables are found, we won't read them for the sake of our time. The first one is found in Matthew 21, verses 28 through 32. This is the man who had two sons that were meant to work in the man's field, the father's field, and be fruitful in their service to their father. And one of them said, "I don't want to go out and work in the field." But later, his heart was convicted for being so hard, and he repented. The other man said, "I'll go out and work. I'll be better than my brother." But when the time came to work, he didn't actually go out and work at all. And Jesus, using that parable, said, "Which is the better son?" And when they properly understood that the better son was the one that actually went out and did the work, even though at first he was hesitant, Jesus essentially said, "This is the story of you. You're the hard-hearted son who says that he's a good son, but doesn't actually do what God calls him to and requires of him. The second is in Matthew 21, verses 33 through 40, and it's the parable of the leased vineyard, a vineyard owner who leases out his vineyard, his grape vineyard, to tenants. And the tenants are expected to grow grapevines, grow grapes, harvest the grapes, and return a portion of the harvest to the master of the vineyard. But they fail to do so. They essentially steal the grapes for themselves. They keep the grapes for themselves. And so the owner of the vineyard sends his servants to confront them, these servants being the prophets of God in the Old Testament. And the vineyard tenants are the covenant people of the Old Testament, meaning this glorious vineyard of the covenant nation doesn't actually belong to Israel. It belongs to the Lord. They're just the tenants. And when they have these prophets, these servants sent to collect the proceeds of the harvest, they abuse them and in some cases kill them. And then finally, the vineyard owner sends his own dear son to collect what's due to him. And they take the son and do what to him? They murder him in order to, in their conspiracy, in order to keep all the proceeds of the vineyard for themselves. Now, all of this being connected to Israel's relationship with God the Father and what Israel had done to the prophets and what Israel was about to do to the Son of God. The third parable is found in Matthew 22, verses 2 through 14. It's the parable of the king and his son and a wedding feast that's about to be thrown for the son. And part of the parable develops into a story about guests that are invited to the wedding who refuse to come to the wedding, and then other guests who are invited to the wedding that show up, but show up without proper attire, without proper clothes on for that wedding. And then it ends with a description of how the father of the son, who's actually hosting and throwing the wedding feast, how he will react and respond for having his wonderful and gracious and generous invitation spurned, and the disrespect that's shown to him by showing up poorly dressed for this special occasion. All right, so Jesus tells this sequence of three judgment parables, and as the Gospels describe it, the religious leaders who have not complete discernment, but enough to convict their own hearts, they draw the conclusion as they're hearing him. They're standing off a little ways, but they're keeping an ear on him and an eye on him, and they hear him tell these parables, and they properly conclude, he's telling these stories about us. And what does that lead them to want to do? Run to him, fall on their knees, and repent? It leads them to conspire even more to get him out of the way, and they hatch a plot to murder him. All right, then in Matthew 22, verses 15 through 22, the second of this sequence of confrontations, the first is the chief priest confronting him. The second one, I'm putting in parentheses, was Jesus confronting them through parables. So I'll call this now the third, which is their confrontation of him again. But a second delegation, a different group now, are going to come and confront him. In the first confrontation, all of the religious leaders as a group came to him. Even though these groups all had factions where they were jockeying for position and power among themselves, when it came to dealing with Jesus, they all agreed with each other and they all threw in with each other, because they saw him as a bigger threat than each other was a threat. But now, since he effectively turned away their challenge, they're going to send different individual groups, each with their own area of specialty in their confrontation and challenge. So the second group is the Pharisees and the Herodians. They come together as a delegation to challenge Jesus a second time. Now, it's an interesting pairing, because in that culture, I don't want to go too far into the background, but in that culture, these two groups despised each other. The Pharisees were spiritual and religious purists. They were most adamant that the Word of God needed to be followed exactly the way it was written, and were literalistic and legalistic in that concern. And they didn't agree with any compromise with the Roman Empire that ruled over them. They were constantly resisting Rome's influences. The Herodians, on the other hand, they derived their name from the famous group of politicians in that day known as the Herods. There was more than one Herod. Herod was a family name, and it became known as kind of a political title. Like the Herods were one particular family that were appointed by the Roman emperors as governors of different regions in Palestine and in Israel in those days. They were in constant collaboration with the Romans. So the Pharisees hated the Herodians for compromising, and the Herodians hated the Pharisees for always causing trouble for their compromise with Rome. But here, these two groups come together and form a single delegation to come and challenge Jesus, because as much as they hated each other, they hated him much more. It's the saying we get in our culture of politics makes for strange bedfellows, meaning there's alliances that are formed in politics that would not normally be formed. And so that's what's going on here. And in this confrontation, and again, this is from Matthew 22, 15 through 22. This is the famous challenge about, do we pay taxes to Caesar? Now, the reason these two were chosen strategically to come together as a delegation to ask this specific question, like I mentioned, each challenge was formed out of those groups' areas of expertise. So the Pharisees had their own reason for asking that question, because as Bible purists and as Jewish purists, they believed that what should be done in terms of paying taxes to Caesar? No taxes to Caesar at all for any reason. Never, never, never. And anyone that does that is a traitor. The Herodians, on the other hand, who gained their positions of authority from Caesar and were authorized by Caesar to take a cut, a personal cut, from every dollar paid in tax, a portion of that dollar went directly into the back pocket of the Herodians. Do you think they wanted the taxes to be paid to Caesar? Yes, 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 always, in every single case, no matter what, you should pay taxes. So this delegation hated each other, argued with each other over this issue, but when they came to Jesus, they were willing to ask him the same question, because as far as they were concerned, it doesn't matter how he answers, we've got him right where we want him. If he answers, don't pay taxes, we'll let the Herodians take the lead and say, how dare you rebel against Rome? And if he says, pay taxes, then we'll let the Pharisees take the lead and accuse him of being a traitor to the better interests of Israel. So we've got him right where we want him. So they present the challenge to him, should we pay taxes to Caesar? And Jesus masterfully, wisely, with discernment and spiritual strategy above natural human wisdom, responds by putting the question back to them and says, do you have a coin? And they pull out a Roman coin. He says, whose likeness is on the coin? And they say, it's Caesar's likeness. And his answer to their question is what? Render unto Caesar what is Caesar's. Render unto God what belongs to God. He answers both parties with the appropriate response. Neither one has anything that they can further challenge him on. The next delegation is in Matthew 22, verses 23 through 33. This is a delegation of the Sadducees. Sadducees are a religious leadership group, but they were different. They were more natural in their perspective. They were more real world in their perspective. For instance, earlier in the Gospels, they were introduced as, they were the party that didn't believe in the existence of angels and demons. They just thought that's foolishness. That's mythology from an earlier, more primitive age. We're the enlightened people of the modern world. We don't believe in such things as angels or demons. But they also didn't believe in something very critically important from a biblical perspective. They didn't believe in the reality or even the possibility of a resurrection. And so they come to him, and they know he's been teaching about the resurrection and resurrection principles. And they come to him, and they think, we've got him right where we want him. They ask him what they are convinced is an unanswerable question. They say, look, you teach about the resurrection, don't you? Well, we've got a scenario for you. In the resurrection, there's a man, and he's married, but, you know, I mean, there's a woman, and there's the husband dies, and then she remarries, and then the next husband dies, and she remarries, and the next husband dies. Now it's the resurrection. Whose wife is she going to be in eternity? And his response to them is what? You have no clue about the scriptures, do you? That's basically what he says to them. He says, let me teach you about the resurrection. And he takes them to a critically important Old Testament passage about Abraham. And he reveals to them, if they had eyes and ears to see and hear it, and if they weren't paying attention, the people that are listening that day in the temple precincts would hear it. And he teaches them about the reality of the resurrection and how this is a thread of God's critically important doctrine that's running throughout the scriptures from Genesis all the way through Malachi. Then there's a final challenge. The final challenge is we've got all of the groups together failed. The Pharisees and the Herodians together failed. The Sadducees failed. And so now the Pharisees say, because they're the most biblically minded of all of the groups, they say, we want to take one more crack at him, but this is what we're going to do. We're going to choose our champion. We're going to choose our best Pharisee, our most biblically minded Pharisee, and we're going to send him mano a mano against Jesus. We'll put him to the test. And this is in Matthew 22, verses 35 through 40. And this Pharisee comes with a very simple but important Bible challenge. Remember, you've heard me mention this so many times before. How many laws are there in the law of Moses? 613. And so he comes and he says to Jesus publicly, what's the most important of the 613 laws? Which one is most important? He thinks there's no way he's going to be able to answer that, because whatever he answers, I'll find a law that's more important and I'll expose him as being a poor teacher to the assembled people in the temple that are listening. It doesn't matter what he answers. I will be able to find a more important law. So if he answers, you know, the first of the Ten Commandments, I'll find a way to show and to expose him for being such a poor teacher. So he asks the question, and what does Jesus respond? He says, the first and most important commandment. He doesn't quote any of the Ten Commandments. Shockingly, he finds another commandment that ultimately summarizes the first five commandments, the first tablet of the law. He says, this is the most important commandment in all of God's law. Love the Lord your God with all your heart, soul, mind, and strength. And then he answers further, even though the man didn't ask this part of the question. He answers and says, and the second is like it. What he's referring to now is another law that summarizes the second tablet of the law, the commandments 5 through 10. He says, and the second is like it. You shall love your neighbor as you love yourself. And this Pharisee is... look at the end of, in Matthew 20, I think we're in 22 verse 40 now to get the end of the challenge. On these two commandments depend all the law and the prophets. And we don't even get a response from the Pharisee. It's just like they sent their champion to go and challenge him, and Jesus responds so beautifully that there's no further words to be spoken. In one of the other gospel accounts, what is described here is kind of a summary of this whole sequence of challenges in which it says, and they just stopped challenging him because they realized there's just no way they could catch him. There was no way they could expose him. There's no way they could gain an advantage over him in the eyes of the people. So that ends the sequence of challenges. Except now Jesus isn't done. He, based on this series of challenges, he challenges them one last time. Still in the temple, still in public, and this is in verses 41 through 46 of chapter 22. And Jesus asked them a question while the Pharisees were gathered together, saying, "What do you think about the Christ? Whose son is he?" He's asking them, how do you read the Old Testament? How do you read the prophecies? How do you understand them? Who is the Messiah? Because Christ is just a synonym for Messiah. What do you think about the Messiah? Whose son is the Messiah? And they said to him, and they said this rightly, this is an appropriate response. They said to him, "The son of David." And he said to them, "How is it then that David in the Spirit," meaning under the inspiration of God's Spirit, "calls him, the son of David, Lord? The Lord said to my Lord," and he quotes Psalm 110, which David wrote under the inspiration of the Holy Spirit. "If David then calls him Lord," in verse 45, "how is he his son?" And this is the verse I was looking for. "No one was able to answer him a word, nor from that day did anyone dare to ask him any more questions." So this ends the sequence of confrontations between Jesus and the religious leaders and rulers of the city of Jerusalem. They lose every challenge. He wins every challenge. The people recognize who has greater wisdom, who has greater understanding. They're kind of silenced in this circumstance. And so they withdraw behind the scenes and they decide, we're not going to be able to solve this thing by debate. We're not going to be able to solve this by argumentation. The only way we're going to solve this is get him out of the way. And this is where their conspiracy starts to harden in murderous intent. Now, in the next chapter, we have a very important development following, and it's important to read these events, and this is part of the benefit of doing this overview of these last week events. It's important to read this next section in light of what we've just studied, this sequence of confrontations in which it becomes obvious these men have no interest or desire in learning from Jesus, responding to Jesus, recognizing Jesus as Messiah. So we have this series of confrontations, and then that immediately flows into the next chapter, which is the chapter you've heard me describe before. It's been a while since we've talked about this. The seven woes, or the seven declarations of coming judgment. All right, chapter 23. We won't look at this in detail, but let me give you the breakdown of chapter 23. The first 33 verses is an introduction to this concept of the judgments that are deserved by the religious leaders of the city of Jerusalem. And then that unfolds into what I'm calling the seven woes. The seven woes, let's just look at one of them to get an example. I think the first one maybe is in verse 15. Up in verse 13. All right, verse 13 says, "But woe to you, scribes and Pharisees, hypocrites, for you shut the kingdom of heaven in people's faces. For you neither enter yourselves nor allow those who would enter to go in." Now, when he says scribes and Pharisees, he's summarizing all of the religious leaders in this city of Jerusalem that are set against a recognition of who he is as God's son and God's chosen one, the Messiah. And when he pronounces woe, when he says woe to you, It's a biblical declaration that judgment is deserved and judgment is impending. Judgment will soon come and fall upon the lives of those that have this woe pronounced over them. It's like a curse pronounced over them. But we're talking not about a verbal curse, but a spiritual curse representing the consequences described in God's law for a failure to obey the law of God, the righteous standards of God, and the penalties that God will bring into the lives of his covenant people when they are in this hard-hearted, rebellious heart condition. And so he pronounced a sequence of seven woes. In one sense, we understand that one woe would be sufficient to drive home the point of how bad their hearts have really gotten before the Lord and what they really deserve for him from him. But why seven? Why do you suppose? Seven is, you know, biblically a number of fullness and completion, like the 7 days of the creation week, as just one of many biblical examples. And so the seven woes are a full expression, a complete expression of deserved judgment, impending and coming judgment upon their lives. Now, the last part of chapter 23 is broadened. This is Matthew 23, verses 34 through the end of the chapter, which is verse 39. In the seven woes, the focal point are scribes and Pharisees. In this last section of chapter 23, it's broadened to describe the entire city of Jerusalem. Now, it's an important distinction. The scribes and the Pharisees are the leaders, the religious leaders, the ones that are most immediately responsible for the hard-hearted condition of the covenant people at this time in history as the Messiah arrives on the scene. And they have the seven woes pronounced directly upon them. But it doesn't mean that the city itself and the rest of the inhabitants of the city are going to escape scot-free. It's not that the Lord is going to bring judgment just on the religious leaders, and all of the other people that follow their lead are going to be left, you know, to their own devices. They're also, the inhabitants of the city and really the entire covenant nation as it remains at that time, is going to fall under this same judgment. But the sequence is important. The leaders are addressed first, and then those who choose to follow their lead and are under their influence willingly are going to experience the same judgments. And this ends with kind of it's tragic, but at the same time it's heartrending when we see at the very end of the section, starting in verse 37, Jesus is now addressing the city directly. He says, "Oh, Jerusalem, Jerusalem, the city that kills the prophets and stones those who were sent to it." And of course, he is the ultimate prophet, and he is the last one, the Son of God, who has been sent to the city. "How often would I have gathered your children together as a hen gathers her brood under her wings?" And this key phrase, "and you would not," meaning you would not respond to my efforts to gather you. He's saying, I've been trying to gather you back to myself all the way through the latter end of the Old Covenant era. All of the prophets that were sent, Isaiah, Jeremiah, Ezekiel, Daniel, and we could just go on and name all of the prophets of God represented by those prophetic books in the Old Testament. They were God's efforts to draw the people of God back under his wing. But they would not. They would not listen. They would not respond. They would not repent. And so he says, "See, your house is left to you desolate. For I tell you, you will not see me again until you say, 'Blessed is he who comes in the name of the Lord.'" So he leaves this declaration. Understand, where is he saying all this? Temple precincts. He's in the temple area. And it wasn't like half deserted. This is the festival time. This is the population, they said, of the city of Jerusalem literally doubled during this festival time as spiritual pilgrims came from all over the Roman Empire to attend this festival. And they're all there listening. And he's saying these words of judgment about what's about to befall the city, and specifically the religious leaders leading the city. That leads us immediately into the next big event, which is in Matthew 24. And that is, so we've got the series of confrontations on Tuesday, the seven woes, and now we have what is called the, theologically it's known as the Olivet Discourse, but I prefer to call it the Olivet Prophecy. Because it's not just Jesus giving like a discourse like a college professor. He's given a prophetic word. He's speaking under inspiration of God's Spirit. Now, this section is found in Matthew 24. It's found in the Gospel of Luke, chapter 21. It's found in the Gospel of Mark, chapter 13. And you may have heard me mention this before. There's always been a question of why isn't this most important declaration by the Lord of a prophecy of impending judgment upon the city of Jerusalem, why is it not addressed in the Gospel of John at all? And the answer to that is, it's not addressed in the Gospel of John because each one of the other three Gospel writers were assigned by the Lord to dedicate a whole chapter to it. What John's assignment was to dedicate an entire book to it. And that is what we call the book of Revelation. So John's version of the Olivet Prophecy is the book of Revelation, whereas Matthew's is in chapter 24, Luke 21, and Mark chapter 13. Now, we won't go into all the details, but let's just read the first three verses, which kind of sets it up. Jesus left the temple. So this is now Tuesday, probably Tuesday afternoon. Jesus left the temple and was going away when his disciples came to point out to him the buildings of the temple. But he answered them, "You see all these things, do you not? Truly I say to you, there will not be left here one stone upon another that will not be thrown down." Now, this was a huge structure. The temple was huge. It was ornate. It was rich. Herod, the Herod that was in charge of Jerusalem specifically, had been, at this moment in time, had been adding to this construction project of the temple. It, in old days, was called the Temple of Solomon, and in the Restoration, it became known as the Restoration Temple. But now, Herod wanted it to be known as Herod's temple, and he had been building this thing for 46 years, dedicating an amazing amount of resource in the construction of this temple. So Jesus says, "Truly I say to you, there will not be left here one stone upon another that will not be thrown down." And as he sat on the Mount of Olives, so now he's left the city of Jerusalem, he's left the Temple Mount, he's gone back down into the Kidron Valley, walked back up to the summit of the Mount of Olives, and they're together with his disciples on the Mount of Olives, looking back across the Kidron Valley at the Temple Mount. The temple is in great visibility across that valley. And the disciples came to him privately, saying, "Tell us, when will these things be, and what will be the sign of your coming and of the close of the age?" Now, I won't get into this. We're eventually going to get here in our study on Sunday mornings in the Gospel of Matthew. And when we get to the Olivet Prophecy, I promise you we will slow down and we will look at it in exhausting detail. You'll be begging me to stop studying it by the time that we're done. But for today, I will just, you've heard me mention this before, this is what I believe, it's addressing what I'm committed to. Many believers in our generation think that this is referring to events in the far distant future of when Jesus was speaking them, events just preceding the second coming of Christ. I do not believe that that's what he's addressing in this chapter. I believe he's addressing events that are concerning the events of 70 AD, which is exactly 40 years from the day that he spoke these words. And in this chapter, and in back in chapter 23, we didn't look at the verse, there's wording in which Jesus says, all of these things will happen within this generation of history. And I believe the generation he's talking about is the 40-year time period between the words he speaks in 30 AD and the events being fulfilled in 70 AD. Now, I am committed to the second coming of Christ and important things connected to that, but I don't believe this passage of Scripture is addressing that event. It's addressing the event in their immediate future. And it's really the description of what these seven woes in chapter 23 are going to look like when they actually hit the covenant people and the city of Jerusalem. And it was horrific when the Roman armies in the rebellion of the Jews in 66 AD, surrounded the city of Jerusalem, laid siege to it, killed half of the city's population, and led the other half away into slavery. All right, from there, chapter 25, you have three important teachings that are extensions of the Olivet prophecy. First is in the first 13 verses of 25. It's the story of the 10 virgins. And you're so familiar with that, I won't go into detail, and I'm running close on my time already. The second part is chapter 25, verses 14 through 30. It's the story of the talents, the different servants that were given different resources by the Lord and then held accountable by him for producing good fruit from the resources they were given. And then finally, in chapter 25, verses 31 through 46, there is a proclamation of judgment upon the city, set in terms of a scenario of final judgment on the final day of judgment. All right, in chapter 26, the next big event is the forming of the conspiracy to kill Jesus. We've already referenced it. The conspiracy is between the religious leaders, and they're looking for a way to effectively carry it out without looking bad in the eyes of the public. So chapter 26, verses 3 through 5, it says, "Then the chief priests and elders of the people gathered in the palace of the high priest, whose name was Caiaphas, and plotted together in order to arrest Jesus by stealth and kill him. But they said, not during the feast, lest there be an uproar among the people." So the conspiracy is hatched. Look down in verses 14 through 16. "Then one of the 12, whose name was Judas Iscariot, went to the chief priests and said, 'What will you give me if I deliver him over to you?' And they paid him 30 pieces of silver. And from that moment, he sought an opportunity to betray him." So the conspiracy is hatched at the chief priests and elders level. But then one of his own closest disciples goes to them and joins the conspiracy. That forms the strategy and the plan to actually carry out this plot that they have hatched. In between, in verses 6 through 13, a very significant event, an event that is heart-touching, and that is, this is now Tuesday night. He goes back to the city of Bethany. He's had a long day of confrontations and teachings, and he goes to eat dinner. He goes to eat dinner at the home of Simon, not his own disciple Simon, but another Simon. And he has Lazarus, who he had raised from the dead, with him at dinner. He has Martha and Mary there. And while he's there at dinner, Mary takes out a special vial, an alabaster vial that she has had in her possession. It's probably her dowry. It's probably the most precious possession that she has. There's an ointment within this vial. And the vial, you know, signifies the preciousness of the ointment because it's a sealed vial, meaning you can't just twist off the top. The only way to get to the ointment is break the vial and pour out all of the contents of the alabaster vial. And it was estimated by Judas himself that the contents of this special ointment was worth 300 denarii. Why this is significant is that the average field worker salary for a day's labor was 1 denarii. So this was nearly the equivalent of a field worker's yearly wages. 1 year's salary she took and broke, poured the ointment on his head, then took her hair and used it as a cloth to work the ointment and to wipe his feet. And in doing so, Judas, we're told in one of the accounts, was deeply offended, saying, we should have sold this for 300 denarii and we should have given the money to the poor. The gospel tells us that his real motive in saying that was that he used to skim off the top of the money that the disciples collected that were given for the ministry of Jesus. And so he says, essentially rebuking her for doing this, Judas does, and Jesus then uses her as an example of a true sacrificial heart of devotion, showing the honor and the commitment of her heart to him. And he says that she did this, she was motivated to do this by the Spirit of God as a preparation for his coming death and burial. Now that ends Tuesday night. He goes to sleep in Bethany again. Wednesday morning, I mentioned already on Sunday, it's a quiet day. There's no account in any of the Gospels of anything he did Wednesday. So I see it as kind of like the calm before the storm, because the events of Thursday and Friday are going to be rapid fire and they're going to be full, and it's going to be like a buzzsaw of events that are going to take place. And it's just interesting that the Lord took Wednesday as a quiet day apart from all of these events. Now, Thursday morning, we've got a full day Thursday, and I've already burned up our entire time here studying just Tuesday's events. But let me at least get a start on Thursday. Thursday was the great day of the Passover. The Passover was the festival for why all of these people came from all over the world to the city of Jerusalem during this week. So they came for the Passover, and the Passover was to be eaten Thursday night. But in order to get ready for the Passover, preparations had to be made. And so in Luke chapter 22, verses 7 through 14, we have the most full account of Jesus sending his disciples to go and make preparations for the Passover, special Passover meal that he's looking forward to eating with his disciples that night. Now, we understand the Passover meal was a yearly event. It was something that was to be done by every righteous Jewish person and every righteous Jewish family every single year. Everyone was required by the law to set aside that week of their year and to take, in a sense, a spiritual vacation, if they're capable, to travel to the city of Jerusalem, if not to practice it wherever their home was, and to enact, to in a sense reenact the events of the Passover night, going all the way back in history to the night that the Lord rescued the children of Israel out of Egypt and into the wilderness and eventually into the promised land. This festival was remembrance of that salvation from Egypt. And so they had to make special preparations, and so he sent them into the city to find an upper room for them to meet. This is not easy to do, by the way, because, as I said, the population of the city doubled during Passover week. It was hard to find lodging there. It was hard to find any place to eat the meal because most of those places were rented out. But Jesus had apparently spiritually prepared for it. He sent them with special instructions. They were to look for a specific man, a specific sign, a man carrying a water jug, and he was going to lead them to this upper room where they would have this meal together. Now, part of this that's not explained in the backstory is that those two men that were sent in order to go find that upper room would also have to go and get the lamb that they would eat for the Passover meal prepared. Each Passover meal was to be have a total of between 10 and 20 people at that meal. It's perfect for the group that Jesus is with, because you have how many people at the meal that night? 13. You have Jesus and his 12 disciples. So they fit perfectly within this guideline of how many there were to be, no less than 10. If your family was too small, then two families would join together. And if your family was too large, they would split the meals into two different meals. So between 10 and 20. And for each of these meals, there was to be one lamb. One Passover lamb. And the way they did it is they had to go first and purchase a lamb, and then they had to go to the temple and wait in line. And this was not a short line. This was a long line, because there were, they estimated some 10,000 Passover lambs that night sacrificed in the temple precincts. And so you had to wait. Can you imagine waiting in a line 10,000 long for your lamb to be slaughtered? And the way it was done is the person that brought the lamb was actually, while the priest held it, that person was to take the knife and cut the throat of the lamb, and the blood was drained into a special vessel, which was then poured out at the base of the altar in the temple itself, the temple precincts, just outside the front door to the temple. Now, they had more than one team of priests that were handling this. So, you know, it wasn't like, you know, one after the other for 10,000. But still, they had to wait for a significant amount of time. And then, of course, they arrived at the upper room that night. We have the longest account in the Gospel of John, chapter 13, is where John's account starts. But I want us to understand that there was a special significance of the Passover, not just in a general historical reminder kind of way, but there was a special anticipation at this particular moment in history. And that was, there was a Jewish tradition taught by many of the Jewish rabbis that on the Passover, the night of the Passover, at the actual Passover meal, the Messiah would reveal himself and declare himself to be the Messiah. Now, they expected this would happen at any given Passover night, any of the years that Passover was celebrated, but the anticipation was heightened this year for a very important reason. Why do you think that was? Just a few days before this, he's arrived at the city of Jerusalem riding on the colt of a donkey, and the people have all poured out of the city waving palm branches and declaring Hosanna to the Son of David. So there's an expectation that if he really is the Messiah, this night, at this meal, he is going to make that known. He's going to reveal himself. He is going to declare himself as God's chosen one. Now, the participants in the Passover meal, you know, they treated it as a special event. They were, every participant was to bathe before they arrived at the meal. And they were to put on their best clothing, whatever their best suit of clothes were. And then they were to travel from their various locations and arrive at the prearranged location for the meal. Now, where Jesus and his disciples are coming from, they're still coming from Bethany. So that morning, they started out from Bethany. They arrived in the city for the Passover meal that night. And it's about a 3-mile walk, and it's dusty roads. And so as they arrive, they've bathed. They're clean. They've got nice clothes on. But they're wearing sandals with, you know, bare feet in those sandals, and their feet are dirty. And so what's the first thing Jesus does in John chapter 13 is he starts the Passover meal in a very unusual and unexpected way. What was expected is there would be provision for their feet to be washed, because they wouldn't want to, you know, like trek dust from the road into this special circumstance of this meal. But apparently the two men that he appointed to make all the arrangements had forgotten or neglected to make arrangements for foot washing. And so what Jesus does is he gets up, he takes off his special suit, his special garment, and he did have a special garment, as we learn later, at the foot of the cross. He takes his special garment off, he wraps a towel, which was a servant's, you know, a servant's kind of situation, the most menial of servants. He takes a basin of water and he goes and he begins to wash their feet. And here's the basic circumstance of what we're looking at. This is the kind of table that they used for the Passover meal. It was a table that had 3 sides for people. And it had this cutout so that servants who were serving the meal could get in and serve, have access to serve everybody, without going behind them. And the reason they didn't go behind them was, normally for Jewish culture at this time, they didn't sit on chairs for their meals. But what they did do is they would sit cross-legged on the floor, upright. But for this meal, they had a special circumstance, and they did this every year on purpose. They laid out pillows around the outside of the table, and they reclined on these pillows. They laid down to eat, not fully flat, but they laid down leaning on their left elbow so that their right arm had access to the table. And they're laying in this way so that their head would be toward the table and their feet would be out like this. So as Jesus began to wash their feet, he was going around the outer perimeter of the table and washing the feet of his disciples. And we know there's a whole lesson there. There's a whole teaching there. There's a whole very important instruction that he's giving to their hearts about his role in their lives and how they should learn from him and take an example from him. And instead of holding themselves above such a menial task, they should have a servant's heart and be willing to serve one another in the way that he served them. As far as arrangements, seating arrangements, we don't know all the details of who sat where, but we do know this, that on the, this, I'm going to say this right here, this figure is Jesus, where he ends up after he does the foot washing. And on his left-hand side is Judas, the man who is going to betray him. And Jesus is the one in charge of the arrangements. He puts Judas right next to him. And on his other side is John, who at one point is described as leaning back on the chest of Jesus. And most scholars believe that immediately opposite John, on the other side of the table, is Peter, who then, at a key point in the supper, asks John to ask Jesus a question. So that's kind of the scenario. That's kind of what's going on there. And we're at the end of our time for tonight. So what I'm going to do is I'm going to put a stop right in the middle of Thursday night. Lord willing, Sunday morning, we'll pick up with the Last Supper. And we'll finish the Last Supper. We'll go out to the Garden of Gethsemane. We will follow through the betrayal and arrest of Jesus. The trials, the multiple trials that Jesus endured. The abuse he endured. His crucifixion. And leading up, of course, to the ultimate finale, his resurrection. You can pray for me that I somehow squeeze all of that in to our Sunday service this coming Sunday. Anyway, thanks for coming tonight. God bless you. I hope this was helpful.